This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
Most of the mainstream coverage of the Trump-Ramaphosa meeting, which was extensive, never mentioned the word Israel, never mentioned the word Gaza.
What happens when political theater at the White House deflects from a real crisis? We dig into South African President Cyril Ramaphosa's visit, Trump's inflammatory claims, and the silence on Gaza with insights from independent journalist Sam Husseini.
And very broadly, that animal experimentation is incredibly wasteful. There's a horrible return on investment for taxpayers, and obviously an incredible amount of suffering for animals for nothing, for no reason. The only people who benefit from animal experimentation are the ones lining their pockets and personally conducting it.
Justin Goodman of the White Coat Waste Group talks about ending the U.S. government's decades-long sponsorship of medical experimentation on beagles.
We are reaching people and we're changing hearts and minds. And Palestinians in Gaza are changing hearts and minds.
A recent poll reveals that the majority of Americans view Israel unfavorably. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Thomas O'Rourke. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa's White House visit with Donald Trump sparked Trump's false claims of white genocide in South Africa, while ignoring the very real U.S.-backed genocide and starvation policies against Palestinians in Gaza. The meeting was orchestrated by South African-born tech mogul Elon Musk, now heading DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency. Independent Palestinian-American journalist Sam Husseini spoke with Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer about the confrontation and Ramaphosa's failure to address the crisis in Gaza.
The recent developments of Trump being visited by Ramaphosa, the president of South Africa, and the interchange has led to some debate about what Trump's plan was and the response of Ramaphosa. And joining us today is Sam Husseini. He's a journalist, independent journalist, who himself has had a history of fighting to get the truth out. In fact, you were thrown out of a press conference in D.C. because you tried to raise these issues of what was happening. So the other thing that's happened with Trump is he brings people in, Zelensky, and then organizes an attack on these people. And most recently, of course, with the president of South Africa and the golfer and the billionaire in South Africa, bringing them along to support South Africa. They've been radically affected by cutbacks in aid, USAID, on food, on medicine that their people need to survive. You wrote about that and what happened at that press conference, because it seems like this is a common occurrence for Trump now in organizing his propaganda campaign.
Yeah, well, it was a very effective and I believe somewhat predictable. I've actually written two pieces about it. I wrote one piece before the meeting and one piece after the meeting. And it was obvious that Trump in February, issued an executive order chastising South Africa for allegedly attacking white farmers. And his administration was rife with rhetoric about a white genocide. And in the executive order, they actually highlight the South Africans going to the International Court of Justice to accuse Israel of genocide. So that's obviously at least part and quite likely a major component in their motivation to target South Africa. And so they accuse South Africa of genocide, and Trump goes into this and shows this video, allegedly showing this, and gives them a stack of papers allegedly documenting this. And Gaza, there's a question about Gaza. in the news conference, but Ramaphosa says nothing about it, and Trump says virtually nothing about it. So there's an actual genocide going on that South Africa had been attempting to expose. And I should say, throughout last year, 2024, I and others were urging South Africa to go back to the International Court of Justice to do more emergency orders, and then to get people like the Algerians to push for implementation of those orders at the United Nations. What needs to happen is that somebody needs to force the U.S. to veto. That is a necessary step, but it would be a good step. To put forward another resolution implementing the ICJ orders. The U.S. vetoes it. They are further exposed as being working hand in glove to commit this genocide. And then what needs to happen is that the General Assembly then needs to convene under Uniting for Peace. This is a procedure that has been used in the past. It was used by the United States when Israel invaded Gaza and Sinai along with Britain and France in 1956, Eisenhower at that point stood up to the traditional colonial powers and said, you get the hell out of there. And because they couldn't get anything through the Security Council because Britain and France had vetoes in the Security Council, as they still do, Eisenhower went to the General Assembly with the cooperation of the Soviet Union, and they established the first peacekeeping force of the United Nations and got them out of there. So that's what needs to happen. Unfortunately, South Africa has not done that. They are now in a coalition government with the so-called Democratic Alliance, which is a center-right, I suppose, majorly white party. And Ramaphosa, in his meeting with Trump, was, you know, constantly talking about resetting the relationship and trade, and how can we benefit each other, and thanking him for the ventilators he sent during COVID, and all of this. And Trump is basically telling him that, you know, he's committing a white genocide. He didn't use that term in the meeting, but his administration has used that term. And Ramaphosa did some diplomatic pushback, but it was very minimal. You even had some of Ramaphosa's ministers talking about, well, you know, we do have a crime problem, and it you know, it's people of all ethnicities in South Africa, which is, of course, very true. And then they ask for what we need is technology in order to combat this crime problem, asking for big tech surveillance issues to deal with this societal problem.
And Elon Musk is in the background.
Exactly. I was just getting there. Elon Musk is there staring at Ramaphosa. You had all of the right wingers on Twitter saying, oh, wow, look at that deathly stare that Elon Musk is standing up for the poor white farmers, staring down the president of South Africa. You know, and Trump is coming with the receipts. This is the whole mantra getting tons and tons of views on right wing Twitter. And then you had this billionaire, Rupert, the South African billionaire. And Musk doesn't say anything this whole time, but you have this Rupert saying, well, what we need is Starlink in every police station in South Africa. This Elon Musk internet / surveillance operation. So, you know, people can go back and look at my pieces. I wrote a piece basically warning about what I suspected would happen. And then something very similar to what I suspected happened did happen. And Ramaphosa just sort of walks away. And I mean, many of us were heartened when South Africa invoked the Genocide Convention in very late 2023, and then they had the hearings in early 2024. But many South Africans that I know, primarily Patrick Bond, a longtime left progressive activist, had been warning that Ramaphosa is, in his words, a quote-unquote corporate tool, and that in spite of invoking the Genocide Convention, South Africa is still selling coal to Israel, still has other direct corporate ties to Israel. Many billionaires in South Africa have substantial ties with Israel.
They actually allowed the Wertheim family, billionaire family in Israel, which is the largest dairy producer in Israel, to buy Clover Dairies in South Africa, largest dairy in South Africa, to take it over. And then they laid off workers, and now they're importing milk products from farms of Palestinian land that has been seized.
Wow.
To bring that milk to South Africa. So they're actually profiting, the Zionists in Israel, from capital investment in South Africa allowed by the Ramaphosa government.
Amazing. Yeah, and I didn't know that. And of course, the Israeli work with the South African apartheid government, it was extensive. They developed nuclear weapons together.
And the Histadrut, the Israeli Trade Union Federation, which the AFL-CIO is affiliated to, actually supported the apartheid regime and trained Solidarity Center people in the Histadrut headquarters on how to operate internationally. This is the Israelis in their intervention around the world, supplying arms to Guatemala, to other countries, to Chile, I mean, on a global level. Well, the rise of fascism, and I think that the techno-fascist Trump and Peter Thiel and others, it seems that their control really of the government now and Trump, it means that you basically got Nazi propaganda going on. I mean, is that comparison to what Hitler did? I mean, you're talking about South Africa, and instead of talking about the actual genocide that's going on, you talk about an alleged genocide of whites in South Africa?
Right. I mean, them talking about it in that way accomplished several things simultaneously. It put South Africa on the defensive. It got it cheapens the meaning of the word genocide if it can just be another epitaph that's, you know, just another slur that's thrown around. It rebrands what is, you know, a U.S.-Israeli government operation of slaughtering Palestinians and allows Trump to present himself as standing up for poor white guys for his domestic base when he's actually going after South Africa in large part because of Israel. I think that this is connected to how another part of the orchestration, the propaganda orchestration, in my view, is that they rebranded the Palestinian genocide as an immigration issue as Trump came in. He started targeting students, started using ICE, so that it became an immigration issue, which is amenable to some of Trump's right-wing base, rather than it's not a genocide. It's part of my immigration program. I'm sticking up for you, poor white American workers. So, you know, I mean, in terms of Nazism and fascism, I mean, we're literally seeing what, you know, journalists like, you know, Jeremy Scale are calling a final solution in Gaza. This is genocidal. This is annihilation. People are trying to avert their eyes from it because it is horrific. There is a massive propaganda apparatus to get people to avert their eyes from it to, you know, I think that there are a lot of levels to that. And people have to genuinely focus on the underlying reality of what's happening.
And of course, the corporate media, the capitalist media, did not really draw the connection between the actual genocide that's going on, which they won't say is a genocide, and the accusation that there's genocide going on in South Africa.
No, most of the mainstream coverage of the Trump-Ramaphosa meeting, which was extensive, never mentioned the word Israel, never mentioned the word Gaza. In part, I mean, that's kind of predictable. What is disheartening to me to some extent is that none of those words left the lips of Ramaphosa or any of his ministers during the meeting. And furthermore, they met privately afterwards, and then after he privately met with Trump, Ramaphosa made some public comments, and he said that he told Trump that he appreciated his peacekeeping efforts in the Middle East. Again, he's just simply buying into this canard of Trump attempting to brand himself as a peace president, presumably because he seems maybe to want to bring the Ukraine war to an end and, you know, got a ceasefire for Gaza when he first came in for a couple of weeks that's now been more than obliterated. We are seeing estimates from the UN of thousands of Palestinian children in danger of starving to death in the coming days. That they probably were many who have starved today. So I assume that there are interests in South Africa that are negative and that there's pressure being applied to South Africa. And what needs to happen is that global peace movements need to be far more nimble and far more demanding and know when to exercise their demands. For example, when Algeria was folding and pulling aside their resolution to implement the ICJ orders in May, they should have, you know, the students from Columbia University should have gone down to the Algerian embassy, the Algerian mission in New York, and said, hell no. We have the tools, and there is such a pool of concern available. What's missing is the nimble structures for people to exert pressure when it's most needed.
And of course, a economic blockade of Israel by the transport unions. I know Sweden had a partial blockade, and they went after a dock worker in Sweden who supported that. But it seems like the world trade unions actually could blockade Israel, stop the armaments, stop economic aid. And that is concrete action that would actually change the situation.
Absolutely. There have been many such individual efforts. There were efforts in Greece. There have been efforts elsewhere in the Mediterranean. Those are all great. What could happen, in addition, with a Uniting for Peace resolution through the General Assembly, this actually did happen against apartheid South Africa. They passed a Uniting for Peace resolution on that, and it called for things like sanctions, arms embargo, suspending apartheid South Africa, potentially apartheid Israel from the General Assembly. There's a whole series of potentially even a peacekeeping force. So these things can be done, and they work together. Initiatives in individual countries or with boycott, divestment, change sanctions can be strengthened by such resolutions from the General Assembly.
That was Washington-based Palestinian-American journalist Sam Husseini speaking to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer. That was Hugh Masekela, Stimela, the Coal Train. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Thomas O'Rourke. In early May, National Institutes of Health Director Dr. Jay Bhattacharya announced in a Fox and Friends TV interview that he had ordered the closing of the last Beagle testing animal laboratory on the National Institutes of Health campus in Bethesda, Maryland. This move has been hailed across the political spectrum, including the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, who said this in a press release. The NIH's closure of its last Beagle lab is a huge step forward in its efforts to move away from animal research. Cutting funding for animal experiments and bolstering human-based research will save animals and lead to better understanding and treatments of human disease, end quote. Journalist Glenn Greenwald spoke with Justin Goodman of the White Coat Waste Group about the history of animal medical experimentation, as well as the fight to bring it to an end.
Justin Goodman is the Senior Vice President of Advocacy and Public Policy at White Coat Waste, the nonpartisan, nonprofit organization I just got done heralding and explaining. It exposed and has held Dr. Fauci accountable for many things, including funding the Wuhan lab, as well as testing cruel, gratuitous, and pointless testing on dogs generally and beagles specifically.
People don't realize that the U.S. government is the single largest funder of animal testing, not only in the country, in the world. About $20 billion of our tax money is spent each year, wasted each year, on animal experiments. So animal experimentation didn't begin as a liberal issue. It was actually a very, very bipartisan issue. It goes back 150 years in the United States, and it was always something that attracted people from all ends of the political and social spectrum. But because of the nature of the organizations that ended up kind of commandeering it in the 70s and 80s and 90s, like PETA, it became a very far left issue that people on the center and right just did not identify with. It was an associated with organizations that wanted to ban and tax everything, and that they saw as, you know, food police gun grabbers. And as a result, issues that could get traction across the political spectrum, like animal testing, which is truly a nonpartisan issue, it was getting caught up in kind of the people's concerns about the broader animal rights agenda, and rightfully so. I listen, we live in a very diverse country. 1% of the country is vegan. Most people aren't. So how do you meet everyone else where they're at? And the idea was to unite folks. We like to say liberty lovers and animal lovers. So people who are concerned with animal welfare, people who are concerned with government waste, or folks who are concerned about both, and bring them together to make some actual change for animals in laboratories. Because despite 50 years of work by establishment groups, the number of animals in labs had gone up. The amount of money that was being wasted by the government and labs had gone up. So we saw an opportunity to really break in there and widen the tent, create a group that had no litmus test and a fanatically single issue focus on just getting animals out of government labs. So as an organization, our position is we don't want to ban animal testing. Most of it's taxpayer funded. We'll cut the funding for the 2/3 of animal testing in this country that is paid for by taxpayers. And then the challenge to them is let the private sector fund it. And guess what? They're not going to. No private company or foundation in their right mind is going to pay to put puppies on treadmills and give them heart attacks until they, you know, until they collapse. I mean, the type of things that the government's funding has no return on investment for a company or for public health, so no one's going to pay for it. So that was our challenge. And we were able to then unite people, small government folks who wanted to cut spending and also liked animals, with more traditional people on the left who wanted to get animals out of laboratories, and bring them together and build this very robust bipartisan coalition of people in the Freedom Caucus, the Squad, and everyone in between to fight against government-funded animal tests.
These kinds of wins really don't come easily, and when they happen, they're often a byproduct of very well thought through and executed strategies. But there's also some component of it that, for whatever reason, breaks through all the other issues and activist groups. And I'm sort of interested in this one because, you know, just my own personal experience growing up, I absolutely love dogs. You know, I just had an affinity for them from the time I was very young. It opened up things for me that I don't think, you know, that were difficult to open up that maybe we never would have had it been for dogs. And I always knew I wanted to have like a gigantic space with tons of rescue dogs, which I now have. So they always played an important part of my life. But what they also did was, having this kind of love for dogs, this like appreciation for what it means to be a sentient being, this majesty that these animals possess, it's kind of like became the gateway for me to then thinking about other animals. I'd been a meat eater my whole life. I didn't care where the food was coming from. It's all hidden how it's made, so we don't think about it. But most people don't need to do any work to think about what pigs are, what cows are, how, you know, sophisticated they are, whatever, because they know they're dogs. So I'm wondering, do you think that was an important component of this, that this is not just like animal testing generically, but specifically testing on dogs, which most people have in their lives, and a breed of dogs that in the most sadistic way was chosen because of how trusting and loving they are in beagles?
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, we can trace back the victory that was announced yesterday to the very beginning of our campaign in 2016, focused on dogs. But I just want to say, that's part of how White Coat launched. And that's why we chose focusing on dogs when we first put out our campaigns in 2016, is we felt like as an organization that the big groups running the show at the time had kind of lost the plot, that they were all in on anti-speciesism and a rat is a mouse is a dog. And whether that's morally accurate or not, in real life, that's not how things are. We have a nation of dog lovers. 2/3 of this country has a dog or a cat in their household and considers them members of the family. And to build an effective social movement, sure, part of it's, you know, idealistic. So we accepted that this is a nation of dog lovers, a nation of cat lovers, people who love their pets. So let's meet them where they're at and start there. A lot of the other groups have moved on and assumed that somehow the dog and cat issue would just fix itself and they can just work on mice and rat issues because there's many more of them in laboratories. And as a result, dogs and cats got left in the lurch. We launched in 2016. We made a tactical and strategic decision to start, let's bring the focus to dogs. This is a way to bring people on the left, right, center together, bring people across this country together for fighting for a common cause. And we released a report called Spending to Death. And this was in November of 2016. It actually came out right after Trump was elected in the 2016 election. And we put out this report focusing on what the federal government was doing to dogs in its own laboratories. So to your point, the government funds a lot of animal experimentation in colleges, universities, private companies, but also conducts a lot of animal experimentation in its own laboratories. So we were focusing on what's the government doing in-house, thinking if we can make reforms there, then we can use that success to build a campaign to then apply those successes outwards towards these non-governmental targets like the colleges and universities that were getting government money. So we released this report, and two of the projects that we focused on back in 2016 were, one, a program that was being done in Fauci's own laboratory in Washington, right outside of Washington, D.C. in Maryland, where they were covering beagle puppies in biting flies and then taking photographs of the lesions and wounds that the dogs are suffering from as a result. And these were maximum pain experiments, meaning it caused pain and distress to these dogs and then completely withheld pain relief intentionally. The other lab we focused on at the NIH was the lab that was just shut down, which was a septic shock laboratory. And this one had gone on for 40 years, killed over 2,100 puppies, according to our calculations and documents we got through FOIA. And what they were doing in that lab is that they would take bacteria that caused pneumonia, pump it into the puppies' lungs to make them sick, and then slice their arteries to cause them to bleed out and put them into septic shock, and then do experiments on them and see how many of the dogs would survive over 92 hours. A lot of them died, and the ones who survived were killed. And that went on for 40 years. So we've been fighting that specific laboratory for the last 9 years, Freedom of Information Act investigations, lawsuits against the NIH for records, grassroots campaigns. Over 1 million people wrote to Congress and the NIH asking for these tests to be cut, introducing legislation with members of Congress that targets this specific laboratory, writing letters to agencies, et cetera. And we were able to trip down the NIH laboratories to this very last lab. And we were told, Congress was told a month ago that not only was there still one active protocol, but they were actually intending on reviewing it and possibly approving it. So we were, disappointed that this project was still going on under the Trump administration, because President Trump, to his credit, and he doesn't certainly get enough credit for this, and a lot of people don't know this, is that I would argue that the first Trump administration made more progress to end animal testing than any other administration in history. If you look at USDA, we exposed the largest cat lab there. Trump shut it down. They shut down dog and cat testing at the VA. They shut down nicotine tests on primates at the FDA and sent all of the primates to a sanctuary in Florida. They retired cats from the USDA, some of them who live with our president now. So there was a lot of great progress. So we were disappointed. And then Elon Musk, Laura Loomer, and other folks started to jump in and say, Trump, what, you know, why is this still going on? You've been in office 100 days now. You got to clean up, you know, your own house before we start going after these other labs. And lo and behold, Sunday, Jay Bhattacharya went on Fox and Friends and announced that they were shutting down this laboratory.
One of the reasons why I became so interested in the suffering and Talon dog experiments was I was doing a lot of reporting on the indescribable evils, the moral evils and the spiritual rot that takes place in, I don't even like to call them farms, these industrialized warehouses where animals are kept and tortured and processed over the years. And I say that because I think, you know, farming life for all of its potential criticism, including that you kill an animal at the end to turn it into food, this is a big tradition, but they treat their animals well. They keep them outside in natural habitats. They feed them. They treat them well until it's time to go to the slaughterhouse. And that's the exact opposite of factory farms. A lot of these programs entail the government breeding beagles. So they're born in these labs. Their only reason for creating this life and bringing them into existence is to immediately subject them to some of the most horrific experimentation that personally, I have trouble even when I'm reporting on it, reading about and worse seeing about it or hearing about it. That's how sickening it is. I think there's often an assumption that, well, there must be some medical value, medical necessity, where they can tell themselves, yeah, we wish we didn't have to do this, but at the end of the day, we ought to be prioritizing humans. And these kinds of horrific experiments, as torturous as they are what ends up saving lives. In other words, there's a medical necessity to them. Is that true?
No, absolutely not. And you have these agencies that are the top funders of animal experimentation, like the NIH, which is, again, the single largest funder of animal experimentation in the world, constantly lamenting the fact. And finally, we have someone in the Trump administration like Jay Bhattacharya acknowledging this publicly and very broadly that animal experimentation is incredibly wasteful. There's a horrible return on investment for taxpayers and obviously an incredible amount of suffering for animals for nothing. For no reason. The only people who benefit from animal experimentation are the ones lining their pockets and personally conducting it and making it. It's big business. Colleges and universities are raking in billions of dollars. College professors have built careers torturing dogs and other animals. And then you look at all the other kind of ancillary businesses that you're speaking about, like the puppy mills. There are puppy mills across this country that are subsidized with tax dollars specifically to breed beagles to be tortured and killed in experiments. Not only that, there's small-scale puppy mills at colleges and universities across the country where they intentionally breed beagles, Scotty dogs, Irish setters, other animals, to suffer from deadly diseases from birth, to be physically deformed, to be blind, to suffer from hemophilia, where most of the babies are bleeding out because they get a small injury that can't heal. This is all stuff that's being funded with taxpayer dollars. So it's a big business, and people become invested in that from earlier in their career. And there's no incentive to innovate, because the second you solve a problem, your grant gets cut off. So what do? You just keep tinkering away forever and ever at the expense of taxpayers, at the expense of animals. You get your name on a plaque at your college or university. You get promoted. You publish papers, and you're heralded as a hero. There's a guy at the USDA who ran the largest cat lab, the one we exposed. They were flying to the wet markets in China, buying dog and cat meat, flying it back to the USDA, breeding kittens, and then force-feeding the kittens this cat meat in cannibalism experiments. They were doing this for decades. It cost $22 million. They killed thousands and thousands of kittens that they were breeding there. They put this guy in the USDA Hall of Fame. So there's incredibly perverse incentives for this community in biomedical research to torture animals, because you're heralded for it, you're rewarded for it, you're given a raise, you're promoted for it. And that's why the best solution, if you're talking about shutting down the labs, putting animal experimenters out of a job, shutting down these puppy mills, is cutting the money, because they're all subsidized by taxpayers and they couldn't possibly exist. And whether you're center, right, or left on the political spectrum, this is just the practical reality of this business, of this $20 billion plus dollar a year business, is that it's propped up by taxpayers. And if you remove those subsidies, it's going to collapse.
You know, when the COVID pandemic happened, and as we know, we had all these epidemiologists telling Francis Collins and Anthony Fauci, look, this seems a lot like it was manipulated by scientists, that it probably leaked from the Wuhan lab. And within a week, he had every single one of them signing onto a Lancet letter saying, we know for sure it came from an animal to human leap and not because, and that is basically racist misinformation to suggest it came from the Wuhan lab. I remember wondering, like, why would these established leading scientists be willing to jump on board with that? And of course, the answer is because between Francis Collins and Anthony Fauci, they basically control all government, all funding. If you want to be in a research lab, if you want to do medical research, those are the only ones who can basically fund it. And then the more I looked at this question of medical necessity, I was finding exactly what you were describing. You know, they would like take dogs at 3 months and subject them to some horrific disease for a year. And then the next time they would take dogs at 5 months and like subject them to the disease for 10 months. And they would keep getting grants every time they just tinkered with it and modified it slightly with no conceivable medical necessity to all these other studies. Is that, like, what is in the culture that permits that sort of thing to keep happening?
Well, I think people like Anthony Fauci are part of the problem. There is a culture of waste, fraud, and abuse and corruption at the NIH. The Wuhan lab is a great example of that. You know, we were the first group to expose Fauci's funding for the Wuhan lab in April 2020. To your point, we were called racist conspiracy theorists and loonies. And then fast forward now, Joe Biden's intelligence agencies now believe that the lab leak caused COVID. And those, let's just remember, those experiments going on in Wuhan, and this is the reason why we got involved in investigating it, were animal experiments. They were going into the wild, capturing bats very far away, thousands of miles away from Wuhan, bringing them back to the laboratory, harvesting viruses from them, and then injecting those viruses into humanized mice, who were genetically engineered mice, and supercharging those naturally occurring coronaviruses to be extra dangerous to humans intentionally, and extra transmissible to humans intentionally. There is literally no medical necessity or justification for that. That is bioweapons development. There would be absolutely no other reason to take a naturally occurring virus and soup it up in a laboratory in animal experiments to make it more deadly to people. The chances of a virus, the same virus, actually breaking out in nature that you created in a laboratory, the chances are astronomically small that you would create the same virus that nature is going to create. So instead, you end up with a human-made virus that could leak out and kill millions of people, and that's exactly what happened. Again, no medical necessity, no medical benefit, but you have lunatics running this agency who think that's actually a good use of our money. And that's why it's great that people like Fauci and Francis Collins are gone. However, Fauci's been gone since December 2022. His legacy is still alive and well at the NIH. One of his deputies just got appointed to be the new head of his division, a gain-of-function lunatic who at once ordered somebody to dig up a dead body to get the 1918 flu from them, from this corpse, to then supercharge in a gain-of-function experiment. This guy just got appointed the head of Fauci's old division, and we have lots of experiments that Fauci funded that have been renewed since Trump came into office. So we are thrilled that we wiped out the last dog lab inside the NIH, but there is a lot of waste, fraud, and abuse to clean up across this country that Fauci personally signed off on, put into motion, both the United States and abroad, but there's no oversight of what's happening. So that's why we've been big fans of the slash and burn approach at the NIH. They just got, the White House just proposed a 40% budget cut for them, which is absolutely warranted after what happened in Wuhan and the cover-up that the government orchestrated. And then, of course, there was the government orchestrated the cover-up that you helped expose of Fauci's Beagle tests, where we had a long list of receipts, like a CVS receipt, you know, from floor to ceiling, showing all of this evidence that Fauci had funded these sandfly experiments on beagles in Tunisia. And the Washington Post was fed misinformation by the NIH saying it was fake news. They ran a cover story saying fake beagle research claims when there was evidence the whole time that it was absolutely true. And they only made a culpa last year. So, you know, you have these liars and losers and lunatics running the government who have no concern for public health, don't care at all about animals, only care about their careers and progressing and keeping their jobs and amassing power. And that's how you end up with a situation like this. So good riddance to Fauci, good riddance to Collins. And we're cautiously optimistic that Jay Bhattacharya is going to do more good at the NIH.
That was Glenn Greenwald on his Systems Update program, speaking to Justin Goodman of the White Coat Waste Group about the ending of the U.S. government's decades-long use of beagles and other animals in medical experimentation. The group's website is whitecoatwaste, all one word, .org.
How much is that doggy in the window? The one with the waggly tail. How much is that doggy in the window? I do hope that dog is for sale. I must take a trip to California and leave my poor sweetheart alone. If he has a dog, he won't be lonesome, and the doggy will have a good home. How much is that doggy in the window? The one with the waggly tail. How much is that doggy in the window? I do hope that dog is for sale. I read in the papers there are robbers with flashlights that shine in the dark. If he has a doggy to protect him, he'll scare them away with one bark. I don't want a bunny or a kitty. I don't want a parrot that talks. I don't want a bowl of little fishies. You can't take a goldfish for a walk.
That was How Much Is That Doggy in the Window, sung by Patti Page. The National Institutes of Health also announced in late April that recipients of agency funding must not boycott Israeli companies and must refrain from participating in programs that promote diversity, equity, and inclusion. Comedian Lee Camp shares his take on the news.
I don't know about you, but when I think about medical researchers, you know, the people working on curing cancer or helping the blind to see and the deaf to hear and the annoying to be less like that, when I think of those people, I only want them to do their work if they support genocide. That's the only way I think they're worthy of working on medical research. You're with me on that, right? Luckily, the Trump administration's National Institute of Health has put out new guidelines making sure that only researchers who support bombing children will get government grants to do medical research. Genius idea. The guidelines say recipients of NIH grants promise they will not, during the term of this award, engage in a discriminatory prohibited boycott, which is defined as refusing to deal, cutting commercial relations, or otherwise limiting commercial relations specifically with Israeli companies or with companies doing business with Israel. What a relief! I cannot tell you how many times I've heard a friend was about to start chemo and I was like, wait, whoa, whoa, whoa. Do you know if the chemo supports Israel? And my friend was like, I don't know. And I'm like, dude, I know you're dealing with this whole cancer thing or whatever you got going on in your life, but it's best to just avoid taking it if you can't know where it stands on Israel's wonderful and justice-based ethnic cleansing in Gaza. This is such a great idea. Thank you, Donald Trump. Such a great idea to cut off all funding to any medical research that might slightly decrease their business relations with Israel. And you'll notice the policy does not say anything about any other countries or states. You could literally be a medical researcher who has cut all ties with Africa, the entire continent, because you're a member of a white supremacist bowling league and you're afraid of what they would think. And that's fine. You could cut ties with Britain because you don't like spotted dick. You know, you had it once in college when you were drunk and you didn't care for it. And that's fine, too. You could have an ongoing boycott against Walmart because you think it's too proudly American. And that's fine. But Israel, no. That is not allowed. Thank goodness. Also, in order to get a medical research grant, you have to ensure you will not operate or advance or promote DEI, DEIA, discriminatory equity ideology. And if you're wondering what DEIA is, that's diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility. Again, what a relief. I was so worried that those doing research on how to decrease the impact of, you know, Alzheimer's might have a ramp going up to their building. I mean, just allowing people in wheelchairs to get in. And can you imagine just rolling up and down the halls all willy-nilly? Or should I say wheely-nilly? And I'm not, look, I'm not saying they can't come in the building. They can be there just like everyone else. But they should have to crawl up those stairs to prove they're worthy. Ramps are the devil's work.
That was comedian Lee Camp, host of Unredacted Tonight on YouTube. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Thomas O'Rourke. A recent poll has revealed that the majority of Americans view Israel unfavorably. The Electronic Intifada's Ali Abu Nima and Nora Barrows Friedman discuss.
This is from the Pew Research Center, which is a well-respected polling organization. And this struck me because it says, and I'm reading from their release, "The public's views of Israel have turned more negative over the past 3 years. More than half of U.S. adults, 53%, now express an unfavorable opinion of Israel, up from 42% in March 2022, before the Hamas attack of October 7, 2023, and the ensuing Israeli invasion of the Gaza Strip." This is the first time I remember a major poll from, you know, a respected polling organization showing a majority of Americans, not a majority of Democrats, not a majority of young people, but a majority of all Americans having a negative view of Israel. And then in this chart, which we see here, which drills down further into these results, this shows the shift since 2022. And you can see again, overall, U.S. adults in 2022, 42% had a negative, unfavorable view of Israel. That's gone up to 53%, a majority now. But you can see even among Republicans and Republican-leaning voters, it's gone from 27% to 37%. Mm-hmm. Among the young, and you can see that among young Republicans, so those under aged 18 to 49, it's gone from 35% to 50%. So according to this, 50% of Republican and Republican-leaning American adults have a negative view of Israel. Extraordinary, extraordinary results. And then on the Democratic side, where support for Israel has been eroding for many, many years, you can see that the negative views of Israel have jumped from, even among the older voters who tend to be more pro-Israel, from 43% 3 years ago to 66%, two-thirds having a negative view. And among the younger age group, it surges to 71%. Yeah. And you have to consider that this is in the United States, where the mainstream media has put its whole weight on the scales in favor of Israel and its atrocity propaganda for the last 18 months. And yet, this is where they are. And that, I think, is why we're seeing this draconian censorship. Because when the elites lose support or lose support for their pet projects and the public is moving away from them, they have to try and beat people. This shifting opinion is the context for that.
Yeah. something also to watch. And I think with that, you know, I mean, we're seeing Democratic lawmakers working with their Republican counterparts to figure out more ways to literally beat that out of people, especially young people on college campuses, you know, trying to restrict people's speech so much, you know, in collusion with these elite Ivy League universities that aren't capitulating to the Trump administration's demands. They're colluding with the Trump administration's demands. This is something that these Ivies, but also state schools and public university systems have wanted to do for decades, is, you know, they see the rising tide of distaste, to put it mildly, for Israeli policies and the, you know, really the normalization of Palestine solidarity activism on college campuses, and the board of trustees and the, you know, the regents and all of these administrative bodies that look out for the financial well-being of the administrations, want to make sure that their research grants and their, you know, partnerships and their corporate underwriting of various departments stays intact to enrich themselves, not the students, not academic freedom in general, but themselves. And so, you know, I think we're just going to see more of this, sadly, but not surprisingly.
Yeah, but this shift in opinion has been going on for years.
Absolutely.
And the Israel lobby has thrown billions of dollars at trying to turn it around and have utterly failed. And
yeah,
it's inexorable, the decline of support for Israel and in every demographic group.
Yeah.
And I see some people commenting and saying they're surprised that those negative ratings for Israel aren't higher. I mean, that's pretty high when you talk about Democrats, yeah, or Democratic-leaning people, talking about 71%. And you look at the shift again in the other groups, we're talking now about massive majorities. And I think back a few weeks ago when we had Wafiq Faour and Zoe Januzzi from the Apartheid Free Communities campaign. And you remember Wafiq, who was one of the organizers who got those apartheid-free, yeah, measures passed in, what was it, 5 Vermont towns, and who was going door to door. And he said, you know, in his experience, the opinion polls are underestimating support for Palestine and overestimating support for Israel. That may be the case. It may be that people are too shy to say it, or the way the pollsters are writing the questions and all of that. But it's clear there's a sea change going on. And I think, yeah, we need to keep that in mind and not be in despair and feel that just because the mainstream media isn't talking about Palestine, that there isn't wide knowledge of, yeah, what's going on and wide disgust at what Israel is doing. And that should encourage us to, yeah, keep talking to our friends, to our family, to our neighbors, to keep sharing the information, the articles, letting people know about these live streams and the segments we do, the other independent media. We're not the only ones, of course. We are reaching people and we're changing hearts and minds. And Palestinians in Gaza,
yeah,
are changing hearts and minds by speaking directly through social media and sharing their experiences, and sometimes sharing the horrific experiences that we talked about earlier. But it is working. It's working.
Thanks for that reminder, Ali, especially in these very, very dark and grim times when we feel like it's hopeless, but it's not, of course.
That was a segment from the Electronic Intifada's live stream on day 552 of the Gaza genocide. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective, with contributions from Steve Zeltzer, Polina Vasiliev, and myself, Thomas O'Rourke. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Thomas O'Rourke. Thanks for listening.